So we have a Sanhedrin. Moshe Rabbeinu already had a Sanhedrin. Moshe and his court instituted rabbinic decrees. Throughout the time of the Shoftim, the judges, we have a Sanhedrin, we have the Jewish tradition being passed on, and rabbinic decrees are being instituted. King Solomon instituted the concept of Eruv, Netilas Yadayim, what we wash our hands for bread. King Solomon instituted his own institutions that we have till this day. And the courts went this way throughout the time of the first temple. The first temple was destroyed. In exile, we have a Sanhedrin running the show. And then after 70 years in exile, in Babel, Babylon, and under the rule of the Persians and the Medes, when they overtook the Babylonian Empire, we come back to rebuild the second temple. When we come back to rebuild the second temple, we are led by a man by the name of Ezra. Ezra is Ezra Sofer. Sofer is the term that was used for rabbis in those days. The word Sofer means a rabbi. That's the ancient term for rabbi. The rabbis in Ezra's time were called Sofrim. Today, Sofer means a scribe. But in ancient times, they called rabbis Sofrim. And the Gemara says they were so learned, they could count, they could tell you how many words are written in the Torah. Which is the middle word of the Torah. Which is, they could tell you exactly down to the T, how many letters, how many words are in the Torah. That's why they're called Sofrim. The people who, so to speak, count the words in the Torah. They know the Torah so down pat. So Ezra Sofer comes and he establishes his special court, the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. And this court institutes things that will fashion Jewish life to this day. They institute prayer as we know it. Until that time, a person wanted to pray, so he said, God, I love you, you are the most amazing, you created the world. He starts with a praise, and then he says, God, please give me sustenance, help me out. God, thank you, you run the world. He begins with praise, he ends with praise, and he asks his request in the middle. Everyone prayed however they wanted. People prayed three times a day, but they said it their own way. Came the Anshe Knesset HaGadola, the men in the Great Assembly, they said, we have to institute one form of prayer. People want to pray, they don't know how to pray, they don't even know the language well. They're mixing Hebrew with Aramaic, with Persian. People don't know the Hebrew language well. We got to help them out. We're instituting three times a day a form of prayer. We're going to help people connect with their Creator. So they instituted Shemona Esrei as we know it. Yes? Yeah, I'm with you. Could you just speak up?
What about the people that haven't been destroyed? I heard this from your temple today, that on the Talmud wall, the church you take, you can't, and place it for a particular point, all the way through the whole volume,
there are people who could do that, yeah. There are people who, yeah, it's called the pin test. It's called the pin test. Put a pin through a book and see which letter it goes through. But that takes a special mind. It's a sign that he learned that book very well. Let's continue. So, the Anshe Knesset HaGadola Institute, the forms of blessing. Meaning until that point, people would make a blessing before they drink. But people used to innovate. They'd make their own forms of blessing. They instituted, you want to make a blessing? This is how you make the blessing. And their institution, till this day, they changed the way Judaism looks. They instituted the concept of muktzah. They came, when Ezra came back during the period of the Second Temple, he discovered that people were doing business on Shabbos. He discovered that people had intermarried. Many of the Jewish men were married to non-Jewish women in the land of Israel. Many! So Ezra established his high court, and the king gave him power, and his high court went and started pulling people's hair out. First they let out a decree. They said, you should know the Torah forbids you to marry non-Jewish women. You have to divorce your wife. They were marrying not only Samaritans, they were marrying people from all the nations. It says in the book of Ezra. Ezra's court decreed, gentlemen, you have to keep the Torah. You can't do business on Shabbos. You have to keep the Torah. You can't marry non-Jewish women. They want to become gerim, fine. They don't want to become gerim. You have to divorce them. You can't. All of Judaism is going to go. Can't do this. The Torah says you are forbidden to marry non-Jewish wife. So the men, some men listened, some men didn't want to listen. So the court instituted by force what the Torah says. And Ezra said, how do we solve this problem? Why are the Jewish men running after non-Jewish women? Because non-Jewish women aren't beautifying themselves enough. So Ezra instituted that you'd have merchants going through town selling perfume and beautiful clothes to the women. Ezra instituted many institutions to solve the problem. He said, how do we get to this point? So Ezra said, we've got to have beautiful Jewish girls. That's why I always tell guys, you're going back to the United States, you're going to Canada, you're going to Europe, Don't go to college with armed Jewish girls. Wherever you go, you have to have a Jewish girl. You're only human. And like we said Wednesday night or Sunday night, we're all made from mud. So mud is attracted to mud. So it should be Jewish mud. We go to a place where there are going to be Jewish girls. Don't assume that you can be in a place where there are only non-Jewish girls and you can stand the temptation. If a person is in that situation, so he has to stand the temptation. So when he gets time off, he should go to NTSY. He should go to places where he's going to meet Jewish girls. But a person shouldn't put himself in a situation where it's going to be difficult. But even in Israel, if a person is going to be religious, then there are certain colleges which are located in areas where there aren't any religious girls. So a person should try to go to a place where there are going to be religious girls. Can become. The question is, do you marry a girl based on what she might become, or do you marry a girl based on what she is? It's a pretty big risk to assume she's going to become. Right. There is the aspect of that so. The Talmud tells us there were a righteous man and a righteous woman. And each one married someone who wasn't righteous, and the woman always drew the man after her. I always tell guys, the men think they're the strong one in the house. Not so. I've yet to see a home where that's the case. Usually the woman is the one that pulls the man, much more than the man pulls the woman. She does it sweetly, but she does it. Yeah. That's for our Binyan HaBayit class to discuss the balance of power. But back to Ezra and his court. So Ezra and his court were revolutionary. They are called the Anshei Knesset HaGdol, the men of the great assembly. They instituted things that from the time of Moshe, you didn't have the Jewish people jump forward in performance of mitzvah like the time of Ezra. And that's the beginning of the Second Temple. Second Temple is the period where we begin having the written Mishnah. The Jews start being persecuted, and our sages, with their tremendous foresight, are sitting within the Jewish homeland. They're sitting seemingly in sovereignty, seemingly nothing to worry about. The temple is built, and they see to the future that this isn't going to last. We are going to be exiled, and this exile is not going to be for a day or a year or a decade or a century. Our sages have the tremendous foresight to be sitting in their own homeland, in their own country with the temple built, and to foresee that this is all going to change. And there is going to be destruction, and we will be exiled for a long period of time. And then we start seeing an evolvement of putting together an organized oral law. Meaning, until the point which we're discussing, the oral law was given from Rebbe to Talmud. And each Rebbe used his way of giving over the oral law. There was a certain base Mishnah. We know, for example, what Yeshua mentioned last night, that the fourth chapter in Maseches Tzachim is one of the chapters we have going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. That's a chapter in Mishnah that Moshe taught it. These are the words Moshe Rabbeinu said. We do have certain Mishnahs that go back to Moshe. There's the Gemara in Chulin that quotes Yonah Omer. Jonah says, who's that Yonah? That's Yonah ben Amittai. Jonah the prophet, that's a Mishnah that Jonah the prophet taught, that we still have the Mishnah the way he said it. So we have certain Mishnayot that stayed in form, but much of the Mishnayot was given over. Each one gave it with his way of giving it over. And we reached the generation of Rabbi Yochanan. The great Rabbi Yochanan had five disciples. Disciple number one, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was a lad. He was over 20 years old. He was plowing his father's field, and he wanted to learn Torah. So he sat by the field and started crying. So his father, a very wealthy man, Hyrcanus, comes up to him, and he asks him, why are you crying? You don't want to plow this field? I'll give you an easier field to plow. So his father puts him on an easier field, and he continues crying. So his father tells him, why are you crying? He says, I want to learn Torah. So his father tells him, at your age, you learn Torah? At your age, you go get married, and your kids will learn Torah. Can you pass back then, please? So, Eliezer is crying on the field. And Eliezer is crying by the field, and he fasts, and finally Eliyahu HaNavi appears to him. And Eliyahu tells him, you want to learn Torah, go up to Jerusalem to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and he'll teach you Torah. So Eliezer goes up to the great city of Jerusalem. He leaves his father, he leaves his father's wealth, and he comes upon a blacksmith named Yoshua ben Hanania, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania. And he asks him to stay in his home. Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania let him stay in his home. And every day Eliezer goes to the Beis Medrash, sits in front of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and starts crying. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asks him, why are you crying? He says, I want to learn Torah. So he tells him Halacha, and he says, okay, now you learn Torah. So he starts crying. He tells him, why are you crying? I just taught you. He says, I want to learn Torah. That's called teaching me. So he says, son, tell me, what do you know? Do you know how to bench? Do you know how to say Birkat HaMazon? He says, no. Do you know Kriya Shema? Do you know how to read Shema? He says, no. So he says, okay. He teaches him Shema, he teaches him Birkat HaMazon, and he tells him, I see you really want to learn. Every day come to me, I'll teach you two halachot, and that way you'll learn. So every day, Eliezer would come to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and learn two halachot. After 2 weeks, Eliezer hasn't had much food to eat. He's eating the grass in the field. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai smells his bad breath. So he tells him, son, keep it distant. So Eliezer starts crying. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai tells him, why are you crying? So he says, you're treating me like a guy who has leprosy. You're keeping such a distance from me. What did I do? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai blessed him. He said, just as the bad smell from your mouth came before me, so through the sweet smell from your mouth may go up to heaven. You should become a great sage. And then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sends word to Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah, who was a disciple of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and he asks him, I assumed until now that Eliezer was eating by you for the last 2 weeks. Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah says, well, I assumed he was eating by you for the last 2 weeks. And they figured out between them that he had nothing to eat for 2 weeks. So that day, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah took him in and gave him tea. Eliezer learned and learned and learned. And finally one day his father Hyrcanus, he's a very wealthy man, his sons tell him, you know, your son ran away to go learn Torah. You should go up to Jerusalem to the great rabbis, take on a vow to banish him from all of your wealth. They want to take the wealth for themselves. So Hyrcanus comes to the great sage, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Word goes through the Beis Medrash. The wealthy man, Hyrcanus, is here. Eliezer's father is here. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai told the students, don't give Eliezer room to sit. The way it worked in the court before the rabbis was that every person knew on what level he was on. And as you moved up a level, as you became a greater sage, you got a seat higher up, until you got to the great rabbi. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai told the guys, Eliezer moved up a stage. No one let him sit. Everyone bumped him up. Every time he tries to sit down, tell him, no, you belong a seat up from me. So all the guys are in on this plot. Eliezer comes into the Beis Medrash, he wants to go to his regular seat, and the guy tells him, no, this is my seat today. You moved up a notch. He goes to the next seat, and the guy tells him, no, you moved up a notch. So he keeps getting bumped up until finally he's sitting at the dais. He's by Rav Nochman ben Zakkai. Rav Nochman ben Zakkai has him sitting there, and his father's behind him. His father doesn't know who he is. And Rav Nochman ben Zakkai tells Eliezer, he tells him, I want you to give class today. So Eliezer says, I can't give class today. In front of you, I can't. So Rav Nochman ben Zakkai says, okay, I'm walking out of the room. You give class today. So all the rabbis are sitting there, and Eliezer gets up and starts giving a speech. The Medrash says that from the time the world was created, such pearls of wisdom weren't given off. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sneaks up behind him and kisses him on his forehead. And he tells him, blessed are you, my son, the great words of Torah that you've said. So his father is sitting behind him, and he asks, who's this great sage? So they tell him, that's your son. So he says, that's my son, that's my Eliezer. I came here to banish him from all my wealth. I swear now I'm going to banish all his brothers from the wealth. He gets everything. So Eliezer tells him, no, I don't need it. I'm not interested in the wealth. Don't banish my brothers. I'm not interested. And that's how Rabbi Eliezer started learning. Rabbi Eliezer became the great sage. He was one of the great Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. His great counterpart was Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah, who was initially his host, that blacksmith Rabbi Shua ben Hananiah. Whenever we encounter in the Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer, it is this Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Whenever we encounter in the Mishnah Rabbi Yoshua, it is this Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah. These two are counterparts. Rabbi Eliezer was very tough, very strong. Now, his Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, was a disciple of Shammai. We are accustomed throughout the Mishnah to encounter machlokes, disagreements between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai is the Beis Medrash, the disciples of Shammai, and Beis Hillel is the Beis Medrash, the disciples of Hillel. Shammai and Hillel only disagreed on three laws. They agreed on everything but three laws. There were three laws they disagreed on. So every time you encounter all these arguments, it is their Beis Medrash. The Tosefta says that until the period of Shammai and Hillel's disciples, there were no machloksin. Why were there no machloksin? Because we had a Sanhedrin. And we discussed in the beginning of the class how the Sanhedrin could come to conclusions. And even though one person is going to say X and one person is going to say Y, we were given the formula how to derive what is the correct halacha, with the understanding that we will come to different conclusions. But there will be a bottom line. Shammai and Hillel. Hillel is the Nasi, he's the one running the show, and Shammai is the Av Bezdin, he's one notch beneath him, he's the head of the Bezdin. Hillel begins his reign 100 years before the destruction of the temple. 100 years before the destruction of the temple, Hillel is the Nasi. Temple was destroyed in the Gregorian calendar, they say 70 AD. We have to have a separate class discussing 260 years that seem to be missing from the calendar. That's a separate class we have to discuss. But for now, we're going to say that the destruction was 70 AD. So that means that, or ACE, after the common era, the way we try to say it here. So Hillel begins being Nasi 30 BCE, 30 before the common era. We have to have a separate class about Jesus, discussing historically, when did he live? Because the Jesus that's discussed, Yeshu, that's discussed in the Gemara, seems to not fit with the Yeshu that's discussed historically. And the dates that they give, 0 AD, God willing, I will post a sign on Rav Lisman's door. I post articles. I'll try to post the article either today or the beginning of next week about the Gregorian calendar, Christmas, New Year's, and when did Jesus, when was he born, when did he die? So you should read the article. It's very interesting. It's all based on Christian sources. So you should know a little bit about what sources they really have and what the church itself is saying about Christmas. So there will be, I will post the article, I hope today, on a listener's door. You should see, I switch articles every week. I put up interesting articles. We'll put up an article about Reform, Conservative, what they're all about. This week I'll try to put up that article.
This is a really cool article I once read. It was like a 30-page thing by analyzing the conservative Kodesh, and so when it went into like what the conservative theology was, interesting article.
I try to keep it down to 2-3 pages, quick. So we're giving you a second because we're out of time. Let's just finish this point and then we'll get to it. So Hillel and Shammai only disagreed on three things. They had only three things that they individually disagreed on. And then the Tosefta says, "Misherabut talmidei Shammai v'Hillel." When you start having many disciples of Shammai and Hillel, "Shelosh imshu kol tzokan," they did not learn by their rabbis enough the way they should. Rabba machloket b'Israel. There was tremendous. Then we start finding many machlokes in the Jewish people. What does it mean that you had many disciples of Hillel and Shammai that did not serve and learn by their rabbis enough, and that's why machlokes spread among the Jewish people? There are two understandings in this. There's the Rambam's understanding and Rav Shri Raigon's understanding. Rav Shri Raigon says at that point we start seeing the Roman influence. We know that there was a great inner conflict about who would take the throne, and one of the people who were up to bat for the throne called in the Roman Emperor and said, "You help me out, and we'll let the Roman Emperor decide who's going to be king." And when we called the Roman forces into Jerusalem, that's when the destruction really began. It took 100 years. We made a treaty with them, and they kept their end of the treaty for quite a number of years. But ultimately, the fact that we brought a foreign force to run the show in Jerusalem, to run the show in Israel, that ultimately brought our destruction. And the students of Hillel and Shammai were living during a period where we have the Hasmonean kings, we have whole cities being murdered by the kingdom, kings killing one another, kings' children killing one another. You read the history books, it's terrifying to see that within the Jewish people during this period you have so much bloodshed. Whole cities were destroyed. A king thought maybe they're going to rebel against him, so he wiped them out. The Hasmonean kingdom was rampant with murder, and at this period, at this time, the students of Hillel and Shammai try to learn Torah. Some of the Hasmonean kings try to wipe out the sages. We have Herod, who killed as many sages as he could get his hands on. Herod wanted to atone for that sin, so he built the new temple. But initially, he murdered thousands, tens of thousands of rabbis. So, the rabbis started seeing that things aren't the way they were until now. And they had the foresight to recognize that this is just the beginning, and that it's only going to get worse from here. So Hillel and Shammai, with their disciples, compiled 600 Sidrei Mishnah. We have today 6 Sidrei Mishnah. Hillel and Shammai and their disciples compiled 600. They take all the oral law and they say, let's break it down to what we have a good tradition on, what we have many students saying, let's break it down to 600 Sidrei Mishnah. And Hillel and Shammai are the first stage of putting together an organized oral law. We said the oral law began with Moshe. The first stage to try and organize it are Hillel and Shammai and their disciples. Their disciples can't learn like the previous generations had learned. Explains Rashi Agon, because there was so much bloodshed, and because the rabbis weren't allowed to open their yeshivas the way they had been until now, so there wasn't the ability, practically, for students to learn properly. And therefore you have students walking away and saying, the rabbi said this, and other students says that. You have students who learned by the same rabbi, and they don't have the same tradition. You have students who learned by the same rabbi, and they don't have the same understanding in the laws of logic as to how to derive the halacha, the way we discussed in the beginning of the class. So even though they're given the laws of logic, but because they didn't train long enough under the rabbis, when they walked away, you have the students of Hillel and the students of Shammai having two completely different understandings and having a tremendous amount of disagreement, as we find the Shas is replete with arguments between base Hillel and base Shammai.
Do you know what the three things were in the history?
Yeah. Okay. They are the first three Mishnayot in the Sechet Tractate Eduyot. They are a disagreement as to when a woman finds her period began, how long ago do we assume it began? Nida. Do we say this second that she found it, from this second on, everything she touches is impure, because a nida is impure? Or do we say from the last time she checked, or for the last 24 hour period, how do we evaluate, when do we assume she became impure? There's one machlokas. The second machlokas is, what is the amount of flour one has to make dough to be obligated to take off challah? We know we have a mitzvah to take off a piece of dough to give the kohen. And the third machlokas is how much drawn water passes a mikvah. We know that the mikvah waters have to be waters that were never in a vessel. Water, once it is in a human vessel, it's called mayim she'uvim, water that was drawn by a human vessel. The waters that are in a mikvah are waters that were never in a human vessel. And if you have 40 se'ah, which is 40 sa'ah is about twice the size of a bat, 1.5 to 2 times the size of a bat. If you have that much water, that's rainwater that was never in a vessel, or river water, so then we say even if you pour in water from a cup, that doesn't take away the validity of a mikvah. Once you have the minimum amount, so then you could add water from vessels and it doesn't take away its validity, but you have to have that minimum amount. Before you have that minimum amount, how much drawn water will nullify the validity of the mikvah? So that, there are two opinions, the opinion of Hillel and Shammai. When I mentioned that there are three disagreements, these are the three disagreements enumerated in the first three Mishnayot, Masechet Eduyot, Tractate Eduyot. There is another disagreement, which I didn't want to go into, which is a disagreement that every Nasi had with Av Bezin. It's a disagreement that went back to the beginning of the Second Temple. So that's a disagreement about when you bring a sacrifice on the holidays, do you lean your hands on it? It's called the disagreement of Smicha. And that disagreement went on from the beginning of the Second Temple till Hillel and Shammai. That's why I didn't attribute it to them. It's a disagreement that really went all the way back. But just a second, should we want something? Yeah.
What was the
Do me a favor. That's a very, very good question. Let's deal with that Thursday night. That question on its own deserves 45 minutes. Because it's a misconception that I think everyone has. Everyone thinks, oh, Hillel was the nice guy and Shammai was the tough guy, and we have to discuss it at greater length. It's not that simple. Yeah. Just do me a favor, remind me your names. I'm trying to get it, so. Ari, yeah.
So, the question is, like, that why you're able to, like, keep
chlorine in the water, and they also keep switching the mikveh water. The way mikveh is run today, in short, is that you have a pit with 40 or 50 rainwater, 50 se'ah of rainwater, and then we say that if you have another pit with water, and the water attaches, so then that other pit also is a kosher mikveh. So what we do is we have two pits. We have one with rainwater, and the other one we fill with sink water. And then we get them to touch, and once the water touches, once they become level, that becomes a kosher mikveh. And that way we could change the water that everyone's immersing themselves in. We could keep changing that water every day. On Friday they change the water twice in a good mikveh. You go to the Rabbanut's mikveh.
But there's no women though.
Men and women. I'm not following. Why do you say that? Right, but it still helps to be able to switch the water. It's clean water. No one wants to.
That's like only if it like touches like a little bit, like the kiss, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You guys want something else? Okay, so let's just end at a.
What about the other between the other one? What about
the other
one? About what? I don't like honey.
That's Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. It's not Hillel and Shammai. These are the only three disagreements between Hillel and Shammai. Not that I remember all of the Shas that well. The Gemara and Shabbos says that these are the only three disagreements Hillel and Shammai have. On my own, I wouldn't dare to make such a statement.
Their
followers had many disagreements, but they themselves had these three. So let's organize what we saw today. We saw that Moshe Ben was given the written law with the oral law. We saw Moshe was given 13 principles of logic with which to derive new laws. We saw that Moshe was told that with these 13 principles he could derive opposite conclusions, and therefore he has to assemble rabbis who learn these laws well and purify themselves of any taintedness. And after they have purified themselves and learned these laws of logic well, will express their opinion, and we go by the majority opinion. We said that the Sanhedrin, the high court, the word Sanhedrin means wise men in Greek, and the Sanhedrin, the high court, would convene and discuss new questions, derive the laws, and each one would try to convince the other one, and at the end of the day they'd come to a head count and go by the majority opinion. We said we had a Sanhedrin from Moshe Rabbeinu's time. Moshe and his court instituted the laws, and Moshe is the only one who could give us the laws from heaven. After Moshe died, no prophet could walk in and tell us this is what God says. We said after Moshe died, 3,000 laws were forgotten, and God said, go work on it with the Sanhedrin, derive it. And then we said, throughout the period of the first temple, throughout the period of the judges, we had this high court, the Sanhedrin, the tradition was passed on. We mentioned that we have Mishnayos from Moshe Rabbeinu's time, we have Mishnayos from Yonah's time, we have Mishnah that Shlomo, King Salman, and his courts made institutions. We said one of the jobs of the rabbis was to derive what the biblical law will be in new cases. And one of the jobs of the rabbis is also to institute rabbinic laws, be it rabbinic decrees or new rabbinic institutions like Nefilas Yadayim and Erev. We said that during the beginning of the Second Temple, we had the special high court, Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly, and we discussed many of their institutions like selling perfume, like the institution of Shmona Esrei, of blessings, praying three times a day, etc. And we discussed Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, his disciple, Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, who became the great Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Rabbi Eliezer, his disciple, Yeshua, the great Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah. Whenever we encounter Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer Mishnayos, it is them. And we discussed that Rabbi Yochanan was a disciple, he was the smallest disciple of Hillel and Shammai. And we discussed Hillel and Shammai, their three arguments. And we discussed that Hillel and Shammai's students is where we find the many, many disagreements, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. But Hillel and Shammai only disagreed on three things. We mentioned Rav Shri Raigun's understanding as to why it happened that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai had all these disagreements. And we'll end with the Rambam's understanding as to why Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai had these conflictions, these conflicts, as the Tosefta says, that they didn't learn by the rabbis enough. So Rav Shri Ragam said the reason was because they were being chased. The yeshivas couldn't be enacted the way they were until now. You didn't have the peace of mind to sit and learn in yeshiva like previous generations had. And now we'll just end with the Rambam and a short story to understand the Rambam. The Rambam says that why is it that Hillel and Shammai students didn't learn like their predecessors did? Because every generation goes down a stage spiritually. Every generation is going to have to be a little bit less than their predecessors. And that reached a breaking point between Hillel and Shammai and their disciples. And that breaking point caused many, many machlokas. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was once on a plane, and next to him was one of the famous atheists who was going to an atheist convention. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was with a grandson, and this atheist was sitting with the grandson. And towards the end of the flight, the atheist turns to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. He's an old man. And he tells him, I want to understand, why is it that my grandson is so disrespectful? And whatever I do, he doesn't treat me with respect. And your grandson gives you so much respect. Why? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky told him, he said, when we teach Torah, we're telling our children, the Torah was given to Moshe. And Moshe got the Torah from Hashem, so he had the best understanding in the Torah. Every generation gets more and more distant from Moshe. So every generation has to learn from the previous generation. What they learn from the previous generation, it's another link. You go another link away, so you have a slightly less clear understanding. When my grandson looks at me, he looks at someone who's two stages closer to Sinai. He knows that I have a better grasp of the Torah than he can have, because I am two links higher than he is. So he respects that. You teach your children evolution. You say we come from monkeys and we evolve, we get better as we go along. He looks at you, he says he's two stages closer to being a monkey. Why should I respect him? Now, think about it. There's wisdom in that. When we say that the Torah was given from Sinai, we are in essence answering a very, very difficult question. If you look around today, every science is advancing. In medicine, what you learn today, 2 years from now, is outdated. You have to stay up to date. When it comes to Torah, we don't find that things have advanced the way they have in all of the secular world. And the answer to that is that when we study science, we come from knowing nothing. We don't know about the wheel, we have to discover the wheel. We don't know about Newton, we have to discover Newton. So every generation advances from what the previous generation had, because we learn what they had, and then we have to advance, we learn more. When it comes to Torah, we started with knowing everything. God gave the Torah and said, this is what's right. God gave us the most clear understanding that could be in the Torah. So now, each generation has to try to catch up, to get back to what we had before. So each generation is losing some knowledge, because you had everything. When you have nothing, so you're always moving forward, you're gaining knowledge. When it comes to Torah, every generation is getting further from the Torah, so every generation has to try and re-get it. And that's difficult. So that's why in Torah we find we say each generation goes down a notch. So coming back to the Rambam. The Rambam tells us that the reason that the disciples of Hillel and Shammai had so many disagreements is because they went down a notch, but it was a critical notch. And that notch between Hillel and Shammai and their disciples led to all the disagreements that existed between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. And we'll pick up from this point next week from Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, and we'll try to get to reach next week an understanding of how we reach practical law today, dealing with the tour, the Shulchan Aruch, who they were, what their compilations were, looking at a tour, looking at a Shulchan Aruch, at a Rambam, and discussing how we reach halacha today. Any questions still here?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of like as an aside, I don't think in Moshe's time they call it a time in dreams, it was in Greek. Where did they get that from? What was it called before that?
I don't know what they called it before that. They probably called it Bet Din HaGadol, the great court. We do find, we have a tradition that the Torah uses 70 languages. That the 70 languages, the sources for the 70 languages was existent before the Torah was given. And the Torah used those terms. And there's a very interesting understanding that the Maharal offers to why the Torah uses those terms. We find words in the Torah that come from other languages. Our sages say, the Gemara says the word Totafos, the Torah calls filling Totafos. The Gemara says, what is Totafos? The Gemara says, Tat in Karti in one language is two. And Pat, Pati in African language is also another word for two. Two plus two means four. So Totafos means four. We have four boxes. The box that we wear on our head is filling, has four compartments. So the Torah used the word that puts together two different languages for the word of two to make the word Totafot. Now we know historically also that the word Totafot, the Mishnah calls the ornament that women wore on their forehead Totafot. We know that that's also true. But the Gemara says that the Torah used many languages. The Torah used words from many languages. We find Aramaic in the Torah. We find many, many languages in the Torah. So the Maharal, if I'm not saying it's the Maharal that explains, that we know that initially the language that was spoken in the world was Hebrew. And then God, at the Tower of Babel, introduced 70 languages to the world, 69 other languages. So the Maharal explains that the words that the Torah used from other languages are words that when the other languages were introduced to the world, God let those languages maintain this word from Hebrew. It's not that in Hebrew we adopted the foreign word, but rather when God gave them the other languages, He allowed them to have these words which really came from their source language from Hebrew. That's one understanding, but you don't have to say that. The simple understanding is what the Gemara says, that the Torah didn't mind using words from other languages. The Torah did use words from other languages. So that's there's no reason that should bother us. We know that we see that's the case. We see it in Tanakh all the time. We find even that the language used in the Torah is different than the language used in the prophets. And different prophets use different languages. The Abarbanel says that in Jeremiah, we see that Jeremiah started his prophecy as a lad. God told him, Yirmiyahu, I want you to go prophesy. Yirmiyahu said, I'm young, I can't go prophesy. And God says, no, you go. So the Abarbanel says that we find in Yirmiyahu all kinds of Greek sieves. That there are things that are written one way, but we read them another way. So the Babel says that Jeremiah was forced to start prophesying at a young age. He attained spiritual height at a young age, but he hadn't yet learned grammar properly. So he was giving prophecy, but there had to be all kinds of corrections to the grammar, because he was a kid. So there are things, those things don't scare us. Okay, yeah. I'm not following. It says in the end of the book of Jeremiah that there were specific prophecies that he told his disciple, which is called Eved Melech HaKushi, or Baruch ben Neriyo, who was a great sage, who was the Rebbe of Ezra Sofer. He was the continuation of our tradition, who wrote what he said. But from the prophet it does not seem clear that he necessarily wrote all of the book of Jeremiah, because he refers to things that he said there and he says write them. There are sources that seem to indicate that Baruch ben Neriyo actually did compile the book of Jeremiah. But you don't have to understand that way.
It's on a coin that has his name on it.
Who, Baruch ben Neriyo?
Yeah.
Interesting. That I didn't know. Yeah.
I think it's an important lesson about the language in the Torah. It's like today, people are obsessed with Yiddish and their Shireen. I don't think that helps from what we learned about the way that Allah was founded in Sanhedrin. It's not uniformity. We have, you know that Hashem is one, but it's not that we're supposed to be uniform in everything.
Okay. We have to, if you want, bring it up on Thursday when you get back, about is it important to speak Hebrew or not? That's something in 5-10 minutes we could cover. Is there any importance that I speak any language I want, or is there an ideal in speaking Hebrew?
No, I think it's better to speak Hebrew, but I mean, the fact that people are speaking Yiddish.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. I.